This is oral history number 46. I'm speaking today with Dr. Andrew B. Jones, retired neurologist who is on the staff of Barnes Hospital. Dr. Jones, to begin, where were you born?
East Tennessee.
Did you grow up in East Tennessee?
Yes, sir.
Where did you first go to college?
Had a little one-room school out in the woods.
That was your school, but where did you attend college?
Vanderbilt University.
Why did you go to Vanderbilt?
Because I was the only one I knew of.
Was Vanderbilt a new school at the time?
Oh, no, sir.
When was Vanderbilt founded?
About 1886, I think.
Uh-huh. Well, it wasn't all that old then, maybe a quarter century. 25 years?
What?
It was about 25 years old when you went to school.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So you went directly to medical school from college?
No, we didn't have any colleges then to go to medical school. If we finished a high school and what they call the academies, that was a little slaver on top of the cake, you could get into medical school.
What made you want to study medicine?
Damned if I know.
Was it a occupation that offered a lot of prestige and money then?
I guess it offered prestige. I don't think it ever offered money.
Did you have any family that were doctors?
Doctors? No.
So you were the first member of your family to be a doctor?
Yes.
It's very interesting. What did your father do?
He's a farmer and stock raiser and horse trader and the usual things that people did back there in East Tennessee Hills.
What was Nashville like in those days?
Nashville? Oh, just a little village compared to it.
Now it's the big city and capital of country music.
Sure.
Now it's called the capital of country music.
Yes. It has all the heifer dust in the country.
Well, tell me about your days as a medical student. How did they differ from the way medical students are trained today?
Oh, well, entirely. If we had enough money to buy three meals a day, we were well off. Most of the fellows who were in school with me lived on two meals a day. Now, some of them, the families had enough money to buy three meals. And we lived in boarding houses, paid so much a month for board and room, and the other difference is we were not spoon-fed. We had to dig in and get what we got in the way of learning from the books and from the teachers.
How did the studies differ? How did the kinds of things that you studied differ?
Well, much. All this x-ray business and all this nuclear medicine and all that sort of stuff is new. I started out with the basics, anatomy. I had to learn every bone, every muscle, every attachment, every hinge joint, and every other sort of joint in the body.
Did you have other kinds of courses? You had physiology, pharmacology, basic?
We had physiology and medicine and osteology, OBYN, GYN, GU, just the same as they have now.
Was Vanderbilt reorganized around 1910 in connection with the Carnegie Report? Was there any big change in Vanderbilt?
Yes.
Did they shake up a lot of the professors like they did here?
Now, see, up until around 1910 or 1911 or 1912, Vanderbilt belonged to the church. The Carnegie Fund offered the medical school $7 million endowment fee if they'd become a non-sectarian school. So the court took the school away from the church. And the medical school got around $7 million. And then it began to reorganize itself. It never had the shake-up and reorganization that Washington University did under Flexner.
I see. So there was not such a dramatic change of the faculty.
No.
I see. Well, where did you do your internship?
Well, the first 16 to 17, I was the intern in pathology and bacteriology at Vanderbilt. The next year, I came up here to the city hospital, because that was the most desired medical training in the country at that time. And Mr. Woodrow Wilson decided he couldn't win the war without my services, so he put me in the Army. And when I came back, I came to the Barnes Hospital in 1919.
Tell me about Army medicine. What was it like to be a doctor in the Army during World War I?
What was it like?
Yes.
Oh, well, you were just tolerated, even that by the line men. The line officers looked down their nose at you.
Well, how was that? Weren't you saving lives?
What?
Weren't you saving lives? Weren't you making the difference between life and death for soldiers?
It didn't make any difference to them. See, the doctors were scum as far as the line officers were concerned.
Did you go to France?
Yes.
What were your experiences like in France?
Well, they varied. See, I went over as not as a casual. I went over, I was the serologist and bacteriologist for the division. And I went over with the sanitary train, which is a horse-drawn ambulance company. And we got to France. I was assigned to an infantry regiment as an ordinary company doctor. Then one day they said, you go to Dijon and get yourself trained so you can do what you've all done ever since you've gotten out of school. So they sent me up to Dijon to do washings and look at stools and urines and so forth.
So did you work exclusively with American troops? Only with American troops? Or did you have contact with British and French troops as well?
When they came through that center.
Did you have any contact with the WashU medical detachment that was sent?
The
base hospital 21?
Oh, no contact.
So why did you come back to WashU in 1919?
Because Dr. George Dopp was here. He was the only good doctor, medical doctor, teacher in the United States. And I married into a family of Methodists, and they got me an internship in the Barnes Hospital before I got back here.
The Methodist Church was a powerful part of the Barnes Hospital administration then, was it not?
What's that?
The Methodist Church South was sponsored Barnes Hospital, and they were very important.
The Methodist Church had much more influence than they have now. Of course, one of the bishops, one of the so-and-so, is always on the board of the church.
So how did you get along with Dr. Dock when you came?
How did I get along with him?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the old man just rode the hell out of him.
What do you mean by that? What do you
you do this, you do that, you do this. I got along with him fine.
Did you say you got along better with him than other people?
I don't know that he did.
I know he had a powerful temper, some people say.
Yeah, I know it.
I understand you met Dr. Villeray Blair about this time.
Well,
can you tell me about that?
Yes, I don't know when I first met Dr. Blair. Because I think I was here when he came back from France. But I'm not sure about that. Yes. I met him early in my experience here in the dock.
What sort of person was he like, Dr. Blair?
Dr. Blair? Very fine old gentleman.
What was working? Did you work under him at all?
No, sir. He was a surgeon.
Uh-huh. Yet I understand he influenced your career in some degree.
Yes.
How was that?
Well, he met me in the hall one day. I guess he liked the way that I walked. He said, "How would you like to be a pathologist for Melanthe?" "Certainly. You're it."
Now, Melanthe was the old hospital in downtown St. Louis. Is
that right? And it was over here on Montgomery at that time. It had been one of the original hospitals. I think it was the original hospital. But it wasn't that name then. It was always run by the sisters.
Uh-huh. What did it specialize in?
Who?
What did Melanthe specialize in? What kind of hospital was it?
General.
Uh-huh.
Medical and surgical.
Uh-huh.
And of course, it had an affiliation with the insane hospital out there. What am I trying to think of?
City Sanitarium.
Who?
The City Sanitarium. The what?
Mrs. Jones.
On Arsenal Street.
What?
On Arsenal Street. Are you talking about?
No,
Arsenal?
The
Lexington Brothers.
No, out there now, right close to where the president of DePaul Hospital is.
State Hospital.
Well, the mental hospital. Where many people sent patients, mental patients, instead of if they wanted to go to a Catholic hospital. Man, makes them.
I wasn't even here in those days.
Well, we'll pick up that name later.
I don't know what the...
Dr. Blair was becoming already a specialist in plastic surgery at that time, wasn't he?
He was.
He was. Yeah, well, he was already in World War I time. He was famous.
He was known throughout the world. At the time I knew him.
Did that make a difference in the kind of practice he had at the hospital?
The kind of practice he had at
yeah.
the hospital? Well, I wouldn't know that. I had no contact with his practice, whatever.
I see. It was just a casual contact that led to your appointment to Melanthe then?
No. See, Dr. Blair wanted a neurologist.
Uh-huh.
And the old neurologist he had, he thought was worn out. So you're it.
Now, I understand you had substantial contact with Dr. Francis Rhodes Fry.
Oh,
boy, he was wonderful.
Yes.
Do you want cream and sugar?
Thank you. What kind of doctor was Fry? Can you tell me about him?
He did neurology in Wisconsin. They called himself a nervous mental doctor.
He was one of the pioneers in St. Louis, wasn't he?
He was one of the pioneers, yes, sir.
What kind of practice, what kind of research, what was their, what was the state of neurology in St. Louis then? The state of the art.
In reference to research?
Yes. What kind of things did they do?
Well, they just practiced medicine. They didn't run any experimental things like Landau. Didn't have any experimental places like Guzet. They were doctors.
But they did do brain surgery, did they not?
These boys didn't know, sir.
When did brain surgery come?
Well, now, Blair did some brain surgery. Blair would inject the, when you have this pain in the face.
Epidural?
Yeah. I mean, he would inject this this ganglion.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only brain surgeon Brad did.
Uh-huh.
Now, the brain surgeon came along later.
Uh-huh.
The brain surgeon was here when I came to the Barnes Hospital in 1919. That was Ernie Sachs.
Uh-huh. Well, you can see I'm a bit confused. Could you distinguish between a neurologist and a neurosurgeon?
Well, the neurologist is a man that uses his fingers and his hands and his eyes and his ears, and the neurological surgeon uses a knife.
I see. Now, how did they differ from psychiatrists?
Psychiatrists? Well, if you want to make a living in neurology, you have to be a psychiatrist. psychiatrist treated those individuals and got a little bit off user path.
Was Freud and his teachings an important part of the psychiatry that was practiced in St. Louis?
I don't think so. You ask somebody else and they'll say yes. I think Freud was a proof. I didn't hear nor there.
Uh-huh. Well, who were the dominant influences? In neurology, if not Freud?
Now wait a minute. Now you're getting back to neurology again.
Freud wasn't neurology.
Okay. All right. Psychiatry, right?
Well, Freud was a psychoanalytically oriented individual.
Uh-huh.
He got you on the table and asked you about your poops and that sort of crap. See, that's a different story altogether.
Well, then back to neurology. Who are the leading names?
Neurologists, yeah, then?
Yes.
Well, Dr. Fry, Dr. Bliss, old William Mortimer Graves, and there was an older boy. I can't think of his name now, here at that time.
Was that before Dr. Schwab?
Yes. And then when I came here in 1919, Dr. Schwab, Sidney Schwab, was the head of the Department of Neurology and Psychiatry at the Washington University. I mean, at the medical school.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about Dr. Schwab. What sort of man was he?
What sort of man?
Yeah.
He was a tall, awkward, gawky, ichabod crane individual. He always wore tweeds. And he'd come to the hospital with soap, shaving soap behind his ears.
One pant leg was always up like that.
What's that? Yeah. But otherwise, he was just like anybody else.
Nice man,
easy to get along with?
What?
Nice man, easy to get along with?
I got along with him for many years.
Uh-huh. Well, he was, for a time, he went into clinical practice, did he not? He left the faculty proper and then became...
No, he never left the faculty. He always had a clinical practice.
I see.
There's no full-time men here. When I came here, other than the neurological, I don't know whether Sachs was full-time, but he wasn't accepted. He's full-time in that he got his own endowment. There were no endowed places except the Bush Professor of Medicine and the Bixby Professor of Surgery. There's no full-time men that I know of.
Well, of course there
were. Over across the street now.
I see.
There's a different proposition in what was her on our physiologist?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
All right. He was full-time. And Dr. Terry became full-time. By the way, I worked for him, too.
What contact did you have with Dr. Terry?
Very pleasant. I, for some time, was an assistant in the Department of Anatomy. And for him, I dissected the sympathetics in the neck.
You should see that.
And I kept in contact with the old man until he died. He was a very brilliant old Peckerwood. He wrote the osteology in one of the anatomies.
He was very interested in physical anthropology and collected bones and skulls in particular, didn't he? Do you remember seeing that collection?
Oh, yes. It used to be over there. I don't know what they did with it.
I think they took it to the Smithsonian Institution in Washington.
I don't know what they did.
That's where you got that skull you have?
No, I swiped that skull.
Huh?
What was the purpose of collecting those bones?
Hobby.
Hobby? It wasn't a scientific...
Yes, it's scientific in that there's variations. You know, you have a scapula. You have a shoulder blade bone. Well, they have different shapes. Your shoulder blade bone may be entirely different in shape from this fellow over here. You may have, and this is called your biceps. You may have two biceps bones. And Dr. Terry was much interested in collecting all these anomalies.
What was he trying to prove by all that?
He was writing a textbook. He wrote the osteology. He wrote the bone pathology.
Dr. Graves did all that work on the scapula. Would that have something to do with it, or just
something else?
Side interest of his.
That was later on. Dr. Graves had the chair of neurology and psychiatry at St. Louis University.
I see. While we're talking about anatomy, did you ever meet Dr. Mildred Trotter?
Oh, sure.
What contact did you have with her?
Oh, just saw her passing, and how do you do?
She was Terry's assistant, was she not?
I think everybody around that had been Terry's assistant. What she was principally noted for was growing hair.
But now bald people?
But now she's become very prominent otherwise.
She's never treated you.
Well, we've talked about neurology. I want to ask about Dr. Erlanger and some of his experiments.
Well, Erlanger was not a neurologist.
Well, he was a physiologist, but he affected neurology a great deal, didn't he, in his work?
Not that I know of.
Well, what about his cathode ray oscillograph?
What?
The cathode ray oscilloscope. Did you come to make use of this machine at all?
Never saw it.
Well, it would strike me now, correct me if I'm wrong, that the ability to record nerve impulses.
Well, that's a different thing.
How different? Wasn't that what he was trying to do?
Well, I don't know. He did some anything.
The evidence I have is that he connected a cathode ray tube, which is the related to the modern TV set, and was able to record how nerves, nerve impulses.
Do what?
He was able to record how nerve impulses worked. And of course, this would inevitably affect work in neurology. For example, Dr. Bishop. You remember Dr. George Bishop?
Very well.
Now, he worked with Erlanger.
Yes. I think Bishop had more sense. Go ahead.
Well, you tell me. you say he had more sense.
Yeah, I think he did.
In what do you mean by that?
Generally.
I see. Do you recall any of his experiments? Bishop's?
Bishop, he's the daddy of the electroencephalogram.
There was an important circle of scientists that were connected with Erlanger and Gotzer, the so-called axonologists.
Yes.
You recall anything about
them? No, not at all.
I see.
That had nothing to do with neurology. Uh-huh.
Well, I'm still a little bit in the dark then. Would you describe your work in the 20s?
Me?
Yes.
Well, I could tell whether you had any reflexes, whether your eyes reacted, your pupils reacted, whether you could feel a cotton prick or a pin prick, or that's your sensation, your strength, and prick your hair and see if you felt it somewhere other place. Had the skull open, touch that part of the brain and see if it made a finger move or a thumb move. That's a neurologist.
I see. How did the science change in the 20s? What new developments came along in the 20s?
In reference to what?
In reference to your work.
I don't know of anything new except this fellow in Canada did all this experimental work in opening the skull and touching certain places here and there.
You know who that was?
Yes, but I can't think of his name.
Did you get into experimental work at this period?
Doctor.
I see. Well, tell me about your practice then. Where, how far did you go? If you travel at all, or did the patients come to you?
Patients came to me,
uh-huh.
or or they came to the Barnes Hospital.
What sort of ailments did they have in the main?
Well, do you hear them talking about multiple sclerosis?
Yes.
That was one of the curses then. The Britishers called it disseminated sclerosis. These various syphilitic diseases, GPI, all these heredophilia things, like these cerebellar ataxias, these things that the Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, and all of the herbs,
Abiotrophy.
Yeah.
Can you explain the last? Explain what you mean by that.
Abiotrophy.
Yes.
That's a disease that develops because Dr. Herb thought it developed because it was a wearing out manifestation. This individual who had been a strong, healthy, bullish man to get weaker and thinner, you develop atrophy of certain parts of the body.
How did Barnes Hospital change in the 20s?
In the 20s? Well, we just moved along this way.
It grew, right?
Yes.
It took on more patients?
More patients.
They added new wards.
One.
They added new wards? More?
No, they didn't add much space, no.
Well, they built the McMillan and...
Oh, well, that wasn't in the 20s, though. No.
Was in the... That came along when? In the 30s?
Now, let's see.
29?
I had the first patient when they opened the psychiatric division in the McMillan.
But it was...
That was up in the 35 or 40s. No, that was after the war, wasn't it?
No.
Or before Roosevelt Slaughter?
Yes. Let's see.
Old lady Amos was the head nurse.
That's right.
I had the first patient in the locked department of the back
building. Opened that up. That had been built
in
29.
The Renard now is comparable. Uh-huh.
What kind of was it?
What?
This new facility, what did it mean to your practice when they opened the building like that?
Well, it gave me a place to keep patients.
Previous to that,
keep mental patients.
Keep them in the sanitarium.
At that time, keep mental patients. We could keep our neurological patients anywhere in the hospital, but mental patients you couldn't keep anywhere in the hospital.
Did it give you any new equipment?
I didn't need any new equipment for mental patients.
I see.
I'm using my fingers, my hands, my eyes.
For treatment of them, he means.
What?
For treatment of them. You didn't treat them with your fingers.
New equipment, what do you mean by that?
Well, just wanted you to tell me. I didn't... What? Tell me about the depression. How did that affect...
What?
The depression of 1929 and the years that followed. How did that...
Now, I'm this side of the depression. The Macmillan Hospital did not open for patients until after the Depression. See, Monty Howard built the Macmillan Hospital. And during the Depression, it was stood vacant. Just like Cornell in New York.
What other problems did the Depression cause?
What
other problems did the Depression cause?
Well, I don't think it caused so many problems. It made people get out and work and think and use their fingers and the hands and the eyes to make a living.
How about the finances of the hospital day-to-day operations?
Well,
did that affect it?
Oh, yes. Dr. Burningham had a hard time.
Getting people to pay?
No, people didn't have the money to pay and they couldn't charge. I mean, when I first came here in the first years I was here, the best room in the hospital was over here in old private pavilion where I had these people from down here in Missouri. The husband in this room and the wife in this room were to pay $10
a room. $10 a piece. Each had a room, and that was unheard of. They gave them the best rooms in the private pavilion. And he was the patient. she was jealous of the nurses, so she had to have a room.
That doesn't make any $10 a day.
That's right. And it was the talk of the whole hospital that they those people were so rich they could pay $20 a day. And that was just unheard of. But they had to have suite of rooms adjoining.
Well, of course, the Barnes Hospital has always accommodated the, in some degree, the needs of special patients. People also who have more money than others, right?
What?
Barnes Hospital has always accommodated the wealthy patient. Is that not the case? As opposed to a public hospital?
Opposed to a public hospital?
Yes.
If they had the room, they would probably
It all depends. Yeah. Now, I don't know what you're talking about. When I first came to St. Louis in 1917, before Mr. Woodrow Wilson decided that he needed my services, the best service that could be had in St. Louis was had at the City Hospital. But that changed, of course, as time went on.
Why did that change?
Why? Yeah. Well, it's just the natural trend of things. I came to St. Louis in 1917 because all Vanderbilt boys who could read and write tried to get an internship in the City Hospital in St. Louis because they had the best service, the best training for the interns as well as for the patients. Then when I came back here after the war and came to the Barnes Hospital in 1919, we had a free service in the Barnes that the charities paid for. I had a clinic down there that I worked in the clinic for many years. And the admission fee in the clinic was 15 cents if you had it. And if you didn't have the 15 cents, you got in anyway. Now you can't get in for less than $5 or $6 or $7 or $8.
Well, what developments in the 30s happened in your discipline? How did neurology change in the 30s? The kind of practice that you had, did it change very much?
Well, I grew, and I took on more patients as they come along. I learned more. That's the only way that I know to change.
Do you remember any different kind of equipment, different kind of techniques that you took on at that time?
Oh, sure. Lots of foolish things. When Dr. Swab was head of the department and I carried toilet paper for him, he had me treat these lytics by giving them Swift Ellis. That you draw blood, let it set overnight, and the serum would separate out, and then you'd shoot that in the subarachnoid space in the spinal, do a spinal puncture shoot in the...
How did you treat with malaria?
What?
How did you treat with malaria? Treat syphilis with malaria?
Treat malaria with quinine.
No, when you had
malaria...
Oh,
you can treat syphilis now. That's different. I guess that was back in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
You see, if a central nervous system is different, now I didn't treat ordinary syphilis. These had to be in neurological syphilis. If you would give these people malaria and let them have chills and fever over a period of maybe a month, if it was every other day, fever, malaria, and then cure your malaria, as a rule, your syphilitic patient would be much improved.
How do they get rid of their malaria then?
Oh, quinine.
Quinine? Same treatment as though they had been bitten by a mosquito and came down with malaria.
What's that?
Same way as though they had come down with malaria out in the...
Yes, outside. In the place.
But would they transfuse with this blood?
What?
Would they transfuse with the malaria blood?
Well, I don't know what you call it, transfusion. I've gone many times out to a malaria patient, draw out some blood, bring it back and shoot it into the veins of the syphilitic.
So what difference did World War II when it...
You mean Mr. Roosevelt Slaughter?
That's right, yes, Mr. Roosevelt Slaughter. How did that affect you?
Well, it changed me in many ways because Dr. Slaughter was head of the department and he didn't like to work. And one day he came along, said, "You're going to have to take psychiatry." So his word was law. So I beat the library and learned a little about psychiatry and kept going to the library and reading and kept playing with psychiatric patients, and I developed into a psychiatrist sufficiently until I'm a board member of the American Board of Psychiatry.
The library must have been pretty good if it was able to give you the literature that you needed. Was it a good library in your opinion?
Over here?
Yes.
Yes, the best one I'd ever seen at that time.
They have the kind of facilities that were able to take care of what you, when you went over to read, you got what you needed, in other words.
Yes.
And they had all the journals that...
Oh, well, I didn't bother much with the journals. I read textbooks and things like that.
I see. Looking back, what kind of things would you have liked to have known in these times, if you, in view of what you learned, say, after World War II, what kind of things would you have liked to have known for your practice?
Well, I don't think that I can think of anything like that. What I did was to try to increase my knowledge so I could teach psychiatry and neurology.
So you did teach?
Ever since I came back here from the University of Michigan in 1923.
Uh-huh.
Been teaching neurology and psychiatry.
What were the classes, what were the students like over the years?
You see the chancellor here?
Yes.
Well, he pushed me in the room a while ago. He was one of my housemen here.
Uh-huh. And you're referring to William Danforth?
Yeah.
So what, was he typical of the students that you...
No. He had a silver spoon in his mouth always. The typical student was just poor devil working like hell.
I see. How do they differ from students today, do you think?
Well, I don't know. See, I haven't seen two students in 15 years. See, I've been away from that. I don't know what the students are like now. They tell me that they're sissies.
What do you mean by that?
I don't know.
They are. They're not so... they don't work as hard, do you think?
I don't know.
Well, I understand you did research on the progressive central nervous system disease.
What?
I understand you did research on progressive central nervous system disease.
Sure. Anything that had to do with syphilis, anything that had to do with any of these hematofamilial diseases and so on.
Can you tell me about some of the things you found?
No.
No?
No. I don't think so.
What interests you most?
Well, learning more and more about the neurological disturbances, what their cause, how they progress, what happens to them ultimately.
Were you?
Remember what the most common... I remember one time we were sort of looking over the records. The most common neurological disease was epilepsy, and the next was Parkinson's, as I remember.
What?
I was just thinking of most...
Well, epilepsy.
Epilepsy came first as far as a number, percentage of people.
And I don't know, syphilis is the top of the list, but I didn't hear none of that.
That was years ago.
You see, the mayor of the city of St. Louis was... What a central nervous system syphilis. I had him for a patient, had him locked up and gave him malaria.
Who is this? What was his name?
Miller. What was Miller's name?
Victor.
Victor Miller.
Was perennial disease more serious what? In those days? Was VD more serious in St. Louis than it is now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Landau told me he hadn't seen a paralytic in 15 years.
You didn't treat any syphilitics for the last 10 years at your practice, did you? At least 10 or 15
very
years.
To what do you attribute that change?
Improved medicine, the preventatives, use of drugs, penicillin.
You worked with Dr. Alexander.
No, sir.
No, you didn't.
Alexander was internal medicine.
I see. Well, I didn't mean work in the same department, but you did some of your research in connection with
him.
They were
contemporaries, same time.
You're talking about Harry Alexander.
That's right. Yeah.
No.
How about Dr. Elliott?
Elliott?
Yeah, G.V. Elliott.
That Elliott family, the partner of the emergency surgery boy.
No, he was younger. I don't know if he had any relatives who were.
What
Dr.
Then?
Bob Elliott was much younger, though, than your age group. Bob Elliott, the one who practices over in Alton with Dr. Weedy. That's the one you didn't mind, but that's the only Dr. Elliott he knows.
Bob is just a boy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I must have been misinformed. I was referring to a Dr. G.V. Elliott.
I never heard him mention him.
Maybe so.
Well, what year did you retire?
65.
65? In 1955, you were promoted to associate professor of clinical neurology.
I don't know what year it was.
What changes did the post-World War II portion of your career bring? What changes did the post-World War II part of your career, 1940s, 1950s?
Well, 1940s and 1950s, I had all of the neurology and all of the psychiatry in the medical school. I taught it.
I see. What did this involve, if you could be more specific?
Well, if you go to school and take your primer, you learn the ABCs. You learn from the ground up about psychiatry and neurology.
I see. So these were general lectures in these subjects that you gave, right?
And clinics.
Uh-huh.
Mostly clinics.
I see. Do you recall any changes that were introduced into neurological science at this time?
Well, all this EEG Bishop stuff came along, and Benfield's work up in Canada came along. That's where he opened the skull and stimulated the brains and made the fingers move and the toes wiggle.
The electric shock when they started doing that.
Well, that was psychiatric piece.
Over the years, there have been occasional differences between the medical school and Barnes Hospital.
Yes.
Can you tell me about any of these?
Well, I was not intimately involved, except in one occasion, but I knew about them.
What was that one occasion? Yeah.
Well, now, across the street over there, those were full-time men. Those were Washington University full-time men. Over here in the Barnes Hospital, until Graham came along. And of course, Ernie got his own endowment from Dr. Sachs. We were part-time. We taught the medical students, and we had our own practice. We made our own living. We made the money. Those fellows over there were jealous. They didn't make enough to eat. The university paid them 15 cents. We were making a quarter. And there's much disagreement. But the fellows across the street, they all belong to executive faculty. They could kick you out if they wanted to, but they didn't want to because they kicked you out. They didn't have any source of income anymore. Now, the thing that I remember most clearly is that a damn Yankee, Mamie Schaefer, got to be the dean. And Barnes Hospital over here was making money. Saxon, D.K. Rolls, and Lawrence Post, and many of us got together and decided we'd give so much, a certain percentage of what we collected from patients, into the school. Well, that caused much animosity. Didn't go over, of course.
You mean they wanted more?
No, they didn't want anything to do with it, because if we gave that money, we demanded some say as to how things go.
But what time was this development?
The early
50s? I don't know.
But it was after World War II then?
It was after Roosevelt's war. Mm-hmm. Yes.
During World War II, was there was life at the hospital much different while the war was on?
What?
While the war was on, was there much difference in hospital life, or was it pretty much the same?
Oh, no. See,
they were rushed to death, the men who were here.
What?
And you men who were here were rushed to death.
Well, I know.
They worked from 7 in the morning till 11 at night.
Well, I mean, that way we worked a greater number of hours, and we had more duties. And
McMillan was started in those years.
But, during this slaughter period, people like, Henry Schwartz, those people were in the service, see? And the neurological surgeon, this one had the work for 4 or 5 surgeons who were in the army, drafted or otherwise. Or they got in some unit to keep from being drafted. Things were changed that way.
Well, sir, how has been retirement been for you?
What?
What has retired life meant for you?
Most miserable time of my life.
Why?
Hell, sitting around and not doing anything.
It's a mistake to retire and get away from your old interests, contemporaries.
What would you have done had you had to do it over?
I'd stick right here until I fell over dead.
There was no chance to practice in East Tennessee?
Oh, might have been. Might have been. I never did try.
I see. Now, in recent years, you've been living near Chattanooga. Is that right?
What?
You've been living near Chattanooga?
Yes, sir.
Do you have family there?
What?
Do you have family there besides your wife?
This is the only family I have.
I see.
Live there in the summertime and down.
Well, no, I have children by a first wife. None lives in East Tennessee. One lives out here in Cape Girardeau. One lives in
Adams, Tennessee.
Yes.
One lives in Houston, Texas. He's a doctor down in Houston, Texas. And one lives down in
Marathon,
Florida.
You say you spend your winters
in Florida.
In Florida.
And the summers in Tennessee on the lake.
I see. Well, Dr. Jones, Mrs. Jones, I thank you very much for.
I didn't tell you a damn thing about Billy Blair now.
Well, anything else you can recall?
I won't. Hell, I haven't told you anything about it.
Well,
Billy Blair always afforded much amusement.
Tell me about this.
He always walked this way like he's going to fall on his face.
Any other vignettes that you can...
What? Tell him about what he said when Dr. Gilhorn was
See, that this Dr. Gellhorn was a belong to the Ethical Society, one of these Yankee societies. And they were having a memorial service.
Dr. Fry told this when he came down from the funeral.
Yeah, I mean, about a year after the man died, see. And they were having it down here on Washington, the Ethical Society, doing an old funeral, walked in that day like that, and they were talking about Gellhorn. He'd been dead and rotten for a year, and he got tired of it, and he started out like this, and he passed my son Otto Schwartz, Forrest, at that time head of OBGYN. He says, the goddamnest thing ever saw. Godless church and a corpus funeral.
Church without a god and a funeral without a corpse.
Yeah.
This was Blair's opinion, huh?
That's what he plumped out saying.
Well, he was a strict Catholic, wasn't he?
Well, yeah. How strict he was. He was Catholic.
I said
he was. But that one was funny, though. Now, doctors, Sidney Swab was the head of the Department of Neurology in Wisconsin. Dr. Henry Crossman was head of OBGYN. That was before my son Otto. No, Crossman had GYN. And Ernest Sachs had a neurological surgery. He was the first neurological surgeon of any consequence in St. Louis. One day, after Roosevelt slaughter, we had a habit of, that'd be Sachs and Schwab, sometimes Crossman, and Charlie Stone, he was orthopedics, and we'd be down at the University Club having lunch. And old Billy walked in one day like that. He said, "Hi, Sid, hi, so-and-so," and he got around to me, "Hi, Abe." And he said to Dr. Sachs, he said, "Ernie, you're the luckiest goddamn man in the world." Of course, Ernie straightened up like that, Dr. Sachs did, and he didn't say a word. He says, "You're a Jew. You married an Episcopalian, and your son married a Catholic. You can't miss." Luckiest goddamn man in the world. Yes, old Billy was somebody, and he could take a face that was all cut up and slaughtered and work it over and make it into a decent looking face.
Yes, I've seen some of the pictures of his work. Well, once again, I thank you. It's been an interesting conversation.
Now, old Billy was quite somebody.